Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. I was expecting a little more than that. that's great. I'm glad to be here with you guys, and I want to thank the committee for having me come out here and wait at the airport for 4 hours and watch my luggage for 5 hours, and I'm just glad to be out here. I want to thank Larry for picking us up at the airport and teaching us a very valuable lesson about driving, and that is when you have two people in the car, it's okay to talk to them and drive. Because that's what he did. He never once paid an eye attention to the road, man. He was just... Me and Frank were picked up at the airport by Larry, and we made the mistake of asking, "How you doing?" And he just stopped about 10 minutes ago telling us, I think a lot of you know Larry. He's a member of On and On. But I appreciate your time and everything. I'm glad to be with you guys. I've got a lot of friends here, and they should be here shortly. It's quite an honor to be with you. It's quite a privilege to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're new, I want to welcome you. I know my sobriety date. a little over 25 years sober, thanks to you, and my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 25 years and not amount to a damn thing. So if you're new, I don't know where you think you're going. But the highest I ever got, it was a sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. I don't need to get any higher than that. I sponsor some guys who've gotten higher than that, and they're no earthly good to the home group. Too damn busy, I don't ever want my life to get too busy for you. I don't ever want to forget that I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And we've got a lot of funny sayings in Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of little decals. But one thing is very true for me is that the road doesn't get so much narrow, but it sure gets less crowded. And it seems like, to me, the best that I can do is consistency. I think that's the most untalked about principle in Alcoholics Anonymous, is people showing up no matter what. Unconditional showing up. Can't be beat. See, I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. And I've never had faith in anything. Because I'm the type of guy that if it doesn't come to me quick, I'm out of here. I've got wings on my feet. I don't hang around for nothing. Especially if it has to do with responsibility. That's made me thirsty a lot. I've ran from responsibility my whole life. Don't threaten me with a 401k. I'm out of here, because that means I got to stay, and I'm not a. There's nothing in me that says we're going to stay. Everything about me has been I got to go. No matter where I'm at, I know I got to go here shortly. Like here, I got to go. I'll be going. And I've never had anything in me that says let's stay and work things out. And see work things through. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't rush into anything. We read on the news this morning that they've come out for a cure for alcoholism in Switzerland. It comes in a form of a pill. And my first thought is I wondered what two would do. can you crush them up, you know? I was born in Detroit. I come out to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old, and got a great mom and dad. You know, my mom's a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loves speed. My mom was always eating diet pills and running around the house around 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, or sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage around midnight, you know, and raking the neighbor's yard around 1 o'clock in the morning and stuff, you know, and just a busy lady. And and she would always, she loved to make afghans. She'd take that speed and make afghans all night long, you know, and it was a small house, and I can hear her just going to town, you know, and everything in the house had a fresh afghan on it, you know. Chairs, couches, my dad's golf clubs had little poodles she knit, you know. Any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And I had no idea that I'd laid eyes on my first tweaker, you know. But she was a busy lady, and she had a lot of hobbies. Her favorite hobby was to get a prescription filled and run down to Savon's and cash in her prescription for those Dexies and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes, because she saved the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And her hobby was to take that stuff and make these big 40 million piece puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert. It's going to be a beige night. She didn't want any color, you know what I mean? And she'd come home and make these puzzles and take her Dexies and smoke her Raleighs and stuff. And if she got a piece that was too big, well, she had a pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that little piece right down, you know. And just a great lady. And I knew my mom loved me to death. Make no mistake about that. And I loved my mom. And I was to do with that lady what I would do with anybody who would ever show me any ounce of love and affection. And I'd play her like a fiddle. I don't ever want to forget that there wasn't a time too inconvenient for me to tap my mom for one more dollar. I don't ever want to forget at a ripe old age of about 21, 22, coming out of an institution, and my mom hadn't seen me for a while, and she's working at a dry cleaner's, and she's about from here to that back wall there, and it's an April morning, and it's raining, and it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I got my street mud on, and I'm standing in this parking lot, and I'm staring at my mom. And the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. To waddle up to that lady, ask her for that dollar, for her to open up this little wallet, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. And she gives me that $1 and $2, and I turn to walk away. And she says, "Larry, what would it cost to get my son back? For me to take that money and run off to Wilmington and die?" I never want to forget that. And the thing that brings it home to me is that you take this man who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and his so-called desperation and is willing to go to any length, and you stick him in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you put the secretary of a meeting that same distance. How come I can't walk to that secretary and ask him for a commitment? But I can walk that same distance and use my mom one more time. And I had to come to believe that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. And the longer I stay sober, the deeper those roots get. And it's up to me to every day to apply this program to me, so to relieve myself of the bondage of self. I never want to get to myself to that point, you know. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. He loved to drink, and he loved to sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, you know. And he's always coming through my bedroom window, you know, and he's a refinery worker, and he's got these boots that are this thick, you know, and I can tell when he's coming in because he's pressing down on my little chest, you know. And he stepped on me one night, and I grabbed his boot, and I said, "You know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? My God, she's up anyway, you know. I can hear the Hoover going now, you know, Oh, man, and I tell you, my dad was one of those hard-working, you don't know how good you got it guy, you know. My dad was a guy that made being a man look good for about 11 years, you know. I mean, he just made being a man, he was a hard-working guy, and he used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. You don't know how good you got it, which seemed to follow me to this day. I still don't know how good I got it. I've never had a long suit of gratitude, you know. And my dad used to hammer me, man, you know, back when I was your age, you know. And he did have it tough, you know. His father choked on his tongue and died at a young age. They found his mother hung in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore, and he brought up his kid brother doing little jobs. And he had a dream, and that dream was to marry my mom, get her out of that convent, move to California, come out of the Navy. And they had a dream, and that dream was to raise a little family, you know, and live that California dream. And I had no idea that I was going to be the nightmare of that dream. You know what I mean? And the funny thing is when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, how I used to run this nonsense about how I robbed myself of my childhood. That is the biggest bunch of crap I've ever sold myself. You know what I did is I robbed my mom and dad of their parenthood. They had a dream of raising a kid. They had a dream and aspirations of somebody running track and going to the Navy and doing all that stuff. None of that happened. I snatched that out from under them, man. I robbed them of their very few dreams that they had. And my dad used to, you know, he was one of those guys who taught me about hard work and you hang in there, you know. And along with being an alcoholic, I've come to believe by growing up and some of my actions that I'm also a lazy ass. I got about a 5-inch belt of it that straps around here, where it takes everything for me to do something. I'm just so lazy. I wake up thinking about my next nap, you know. I mean, you know, I'll just put it off till tomorrow if we can, you know. Drive my wife nuts to this day, you know. And when you have an ego like mine and you don't want to do anything, you grow up with this huge ego and you find yourself doing average little things expecting standing ovations. You know what I mean? You know, you go to work and you think the boss is in the office and he's going, oh my God, Jesus, that guy just did 8 hours of work, man. They don't make them like that anymore, you know what I mean? You know, and God, my poor little wife, you know, you do these just things you're supposed to be doing and you think there should be parades all the time, you know. He put away his sock. Oh God, bring in the band, you know. You know, and my poor little wife, I put a toilet seat on, you know, and I waited for months for her to say something, you know. And we're busy in AA, you know, and we'd come home from our meeting, and she'd go into the bathroom, and it's a nice piece of cherry wood, you know, and it just drove me nuts, you know. She'd go into the bathroom, and I'd be in the bedroom, and I'd just be rocking. I'm going, my God, how selfish can you be, Rosie? I mean, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood you're sitting on, you know. What are they teaching this lady in those stag meetings, you know? You know, and she finally came out of there one night, and I had to tell her. You know, I said, gee, you know, that's a brand new piece of wood you're sitting on in there, you know? She goes, I know, and it's loose. You know, there's no pleasing these women in AA, you know? But I tell you, at around 11 years old, and I'm not, you know, I didn't go crazy for 11 years old. I'm a kid doing average things, you know, and I can do them. I can run and play and get D's and sneak off from school and everything. But it seemed to be that everybody around me seemed to get a certain satisfaction out of being normal. Everybody around me had a certain satisfaction out of going to school and doing these things, and I'm doing these things, and there's something going on with me that there's a piece missing here. I can do everything that everybody else, and I'm not getting any type of satisfaction with normal living, you know? And I felt guilty and ashamed about that, and I couldn't run off to my dad and tell him like stuff like that. But I tell you, at around 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. I ran off into a garage with a couple guys, and we got us a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And my God, that felt better than any home run I ever hit, let me tell you, you know? I was crying and snorting and throwing up, and God, I loved it. I couldn't wait to have some more of that stuff, man. I'll never forget the effect produced by that first drink because it made being Larry okay. And I've never been okay with Larry. I've always had a doubt about me, always running around with this big question mark on my forehead, wondering what the hell is going on with me and everything around me. And I tell you, I took a shot of alcohol, and for a brief moment, it evened out the playing field. And that's all I ever wanted. I didn't want to be you know, light years above people. I just wanted to be on the same playing field. And that shot of alcohol, even for that short period of time, put me on the same playing field. Now, I'm 11 years old. I didn't head off to Skid Row the next day or anything like that, you know. But I did jot down the address, you know. And I tell you, my little dream all through life, if I ever had one, was that one of these days I'm going to think and feel and be normal, because I know there's something about me that isn't. Because there wasn't anything that I could pin how crazy I felt on going around me in that house. I couldn't pin it on anything, and that drove me absolutely nuts. Why do I feel so goofy? You know, and I started hanging around some guys and stuff like that, and I'm a freshman in high school, and I started hanging around, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and out on the West Coast, we used to lower our cars down, you know. Yeah, we'd get our Chevrolets down to the dang ground, you know, and get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and drive around and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day, and the Four Tops came on, I just start sinking in my damn truck, you know. I had my big hair up there. I had white T-shirts with black khaki pants that came up to here, you know. Some of the women were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know. I'm driving around with my big hair and my big feet and my big ideas, wondering what the hell you're staring at. What are you looking at, you know? And I got my big frown on because my ass hurts from driving around all night like that, you know. And I got all my buddies in my car, and they all got cool nicknames like, you know, Pooch and Snoopy and Loopy and stuff like that, you know. And I loved it, man. I loved it. I remember one day, you know, I ran into a kid like that. You know, I was up at the mall several years ago, and this kid comes walking by me, you know, and he's shaved bald. He's got a tank top on. He's got all these tattoos, you know. He's got these big pants that you could put about five other kids in there. He's got three phones because he's an important kid, you know, and I walk by him, he's got his mom's earrings on, he's got a big hole in his ear, you can put your finger in there, you know, and he's got a ruby in here, he's got a ball bearing in here, he's got a safety pin in his eye, you know, he's got a ball bearing in his tongue, got a chain to his wallet, and I walk by the guy and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I said, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, man, you know." What, you know, I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40, you know, get that son of a bitch to move, you know. I understand that, you know, and I started talking to the little goof, you know, and now I sponsor him, you know. He lives down in Chula Vista, his name's Ron, and, you know, God, when he was new, he would call me up like only, you know, "Sponsor, what do you want me to do?" And I said, "Well, gee, Ronnie, why don't you unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, you know, and come on out of there, you know." And I go to these meetings and I feel so different. I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ron, how about that, you know?" And, you know, when you sponsor guys, you always get these guys who have your defects of character times 10. You know what I mean? And this guy was a lazy ass, man. Let me tell you, man. I love it. He's an old Navy guy, which explains some of it, you know. And he just, oh, man, you got to pay him to set an alarm, man. He just ain't doing nothing, man, you know. And he's finally 3 months sober. I said, "You know, Ron, if you don't get a job, this sponsor thing is jeopardized, man." I said, "I don't sponsor takers. I want you to put something in that bucket, you know. You're eating five donuts an hour, you know. And this guy called me up. He was so happy. He finally got his first job. Three times a week, he would go to a sperm bank. Now, can you imagine this guy every morning, you know, getting that cup of coffee, getting that lunch bucket, getting that Hustler magazine, going to work. You know? Gonna go to that hands-on job, man. You know. God bless his little heart. He's now sober. He lives in Utah, and he's doing good over there. And in fact, he works for some city. He's a lawnmower or something like that over there. He's doing great. And, you know, I'm bouncing around with these guys, and I found life in the back. Yeah, I mean, I found life in that Chevrolet, man. You couldn't tell me. Every ounce of whiskey I drank and cheap wine, I love cheap wine. I started off on my old man's Thunderbird and went down. You know, I just... Because when you drink that wine, it feels like it's going to do something. There's no doubt about it. It's going to burn the sin right out of you. You know what I mean? And if you're feeling goofy, it'll burn that. Everything's a burning. And the more it burns, the more I loved it. You know, you just... You know stuff was happening, man, you know. And I remember me and Rudy were bouncing around one night down Whittier Boulevard. And we'd come into Torrance, you know, and these guys want to go into the Jack in the Box. And pull into the Jack in the Box, Larry. So I pull into the Jack in the Box, and that little kid start yelling at me, you know, can I have your order, please? And, God, I can't see the kid, you know. I can't see the puppet, and the puppet's yelling at me, you know. And so I drive around, you know, and I hear this big crash, you know, and this puppet's head's hanging down, you know. And I run over the puppet. The cops come. They throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the place. And I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. You know, let Rudy drive, you know. I'll ride shotgun. And there ain't nothing like riding shotgun. You can drink and look at yourself in that mirror and just be captivated, you know. I mean, you want to get an Alky's attention, you put that little mirror in front of him and just, oh, my God, you know. And the more I drank, the better looking I got, you know. I said, Jesus, man, you ought to be an underwear model. Look at you, you know. You got cigarette butt stuck in your hair. You got some vomit on your T-shirt, you know. And, my God, when I feel like that, when I look like that, I feel like dancing, you know. I'm feeling foxy, you know, and... God, you go into that little Revelair bar and you find that little Mexican and she looks just like you, you know. She's got her hair up real big, got little flies stuck in her hair, got her eyelashes all over the place, you know. And you know it's a match made in heaven, you know. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved getting drunk and going to those bars. I loved dancing, you know. And I love the way that... And I tell you, I can explain my drinking like this. And that is, when I drank... And I drank every time I drank, it opened up the most beautiful picture window that Larry would step into. Boom! And I tell you, it was the most beautiful spot in my life. The most wonderful place to be. And thank God for that phenomenon of craving, because that kept that little window open. It kept it, and I didn't know nothing about blackouts or nothing, but all I wanted was that big, beautiful picture, because, man, there was a place that I was in that nothing could hurt me. I was as safe as I ever been and just loving it, man. And the problem with my drinking is that the longer I drank, the smaller the window got. And the smaller the window got. And the smaller the window got. And the more my demand for that window to open got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no window. There was just a prayer that maybe one day I can look in a little keyhole and see a glimpse. But I had this obsession that maybe somehow, someday, this time it's going to be different. And that's the idea that almost killed me. You see, I've got alcoholic insanity. See, if you're new and you're not doing AA, I want to welcome you, but you're in the worst place you can be. You're not drinking and you're not doing AA. And you're just not drinking. And for an alcoholic of my type, that place drove me to drink. Sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. And I wouldn't drink, and I would stay not drinking. And the longer I stayed sober, the worse I felt. And coming to AA and watching your life flourish did not make me feel good, you know. And I had this notion, and I would come to AA, and to the untrained eye, it looked like people were coming here, and they were not drinking. And they were getting little jobs, and they were getting little cars, and they were getting little apartments, and getting people to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looked like the treatment for alcoholism was normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. Because we've got people sitting in this room right now who couldn't fit another car in their driveway. But they seem to be a little restless, and they're irritable, and they're discontented. Because the solution of alcoholism, for me, has nothing to do with the satisfaction of the material. You can get those things with hard work and good fortune. But the thing that takes away the insane idea that this time is going to be different is me and you and that book and the perpetuation of this gift. Perpetuation. Put your hands in the air. No, you know, it's perpetuation. This thing was not designed for me to come and get mine and leave you. The most beautiful picture Alcoholics Anonymous has is those two guys and the man on the bed. Yeah. Now, you know what I'm saying? Do you think that they're telling that guy, hey, you better work some more overtime? This isn't about coming and getting. This is about me and you perpetuating this gift. And when I hear people talk about, well, I've got to rework the steps again. I've got to rework. I understand that. But my God, the next time you go through them, take somebody with you. That's the idea. We want to go in and work on ourselves and just, you know, stay at home and work on our defects, you know. There's nothing worse than me talking about me, you know. I mean, that's an e-ticket to hell right there, you know. Well, I think I'll stay home and work on the old sloth. I'll figure this out, you know. And I had no idea, and our book, our beautiful book, Alcoholics Anonymous, explains that so well. And the alcoholic insanity, if you're new, I can explain it to you, help you, how it comes to me, and maybe you can identify with this, is that you take an alcoholic like me. I'll take my own life, which is the only one that I can observe. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm 30 years old, and I look past my life till I was 11, and I see all the destruction. I see all the pain. I see all the circumstances. I've seen all the breaks people have given me. I've seen all the opportunities. I've seen all the physical damage, my liver, things, stuff like, I see all the broken hearts, moms, dads, little bit. I see all of that. I see jail sentences. I see insane asylums. I see all that. And the alcoholic insanity that I have is that you sober me up. And after 2 or 3 days, I have this idea that maybe this time it's going to be different. I can look at my life and come up with the profound conclusion that maybe this time it'll work out good. And that's alcoholic insanity, and you can't medicate that. You can medicate depressions and you can anxiety and bipolar, you can do all that, but they haven't found a pill to take away this time it's going to be different. They can't do it because they can't detect it. Nobody knows when it's coming on. The book says not a cloud in the horizon. The book says we don't have a mental defense. Well, shit, why bother? Let's go. You know what I mean? If that's the case, we don't know when the big doom is coming. You know what I mean? Let's get out of here if there's no mental. Well, what do we got? We got a spiritual defense. You've got a spiritual defense, which happens to be me, you, our home group, and the perpetuation of this gift. Getting there at your home group. Getting with your sponsor. And I tell you, if you're lying to your sponsor, you're living a lie. This whole thing becomes a sham. You may as well pack it up and go home. Because that's the most vital tool in your whole sobriety is a man and his relationship with his sponsor. There is nothing finer than a person and a sponsor. There is a degree of identity and lifelong relationship that is unbelievable. You relate to your sponsor like no one else. And I never want to jeopardize that. I can hiss and boo and carry on with a lot, but man, me and my sponsor got a beautiful relationship, and it has to do with me telling him my secrets, me telling him how goofy I am. And I made a big mistake when I was new, is I tried to please my sponsor. Fell into that trap because I was doing it with Dad, and I wanted to please my sponsor. Oh, I went into my home group, and there's, you know, 200 people in this home group, and, you know, and I see all these guys around my sponsor. And it was clear that he loved them better. It was clear, you know. Oh, yeah, he's got his arms around him, you know, talking about golfing and shit, you know. They're still having a good... And I'm new, and I'm just, you know, like that, you know. And it just annoyed me. And every time Johnny would go off somewhere, I'd call up these guys, and I'd say, hey, Bob, how come Johnny likes you better? And I'd be like, hey, man, it ain't like that. He just knows us longer, you know. Give him... You know how many guys he sees coming in and going, you know. You don't need to try to please her. He knows you're a goof. You know what I mean? Get yourself some buddies that you can talk to about your sponsor, you know? And, you know? And quit trying. And I learned that, you know what happens to me when I'm pleasing my sponsor or trying to? Is I hold back secrets because I want his nod of approval. And I had to learn not to do that. He knows I'm a goof. You know what I mean? And that helped me a lot. And I'm driving around, like I said, with all those, and I've got this insane idea that I'm thinking that if I hit a bottom, that would keep me sober, you know. Maybe if I hit a bottom, and, you know, the memory of my last drunk keeps me sober. Well, I'm an alcoholic. The memory of my last drunk doesn't keep me sober. The memory of my last drunk, no matter how hideous it is always pushed aside by the pain that I feel today. It overrides that. I don't care how hideous it was. And this time it's going to be different. Our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, he says, the only answer we have is entire abstinence. This starts the seething cauldron of debate. You bet. I've been debating that my entire life, man, because I get abstinence and I stay not drinking, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I see these guys from Los Angeles with their ties on saying, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you. I came in with that guy, you know what I mean? And I had no idea that I was defenseless, you know what I mean? I think the saddest time of the alcoholic's life, the saddest time of the alcoholic's life is when he gets to the point where he's even pondering the idea of not drinking. He gets to that place where he's even pondering that idea and he can't stop, even when he wants to. And he puts his little feet on the ground and he looks himself in the mirror and says, today's the day. Today's the day, man. And he's shaken and he's alone and he's afraid and he's hallucinating. Today's the day, man. All to be pushed aside, man. At around 12 o'clock, he's over at Eddie's liquor store. You know what I mean? Knowing perfectly well. And I lived like that for a long time, man. You know, I had fun with those guys that I didn't know that my little window was getting smaller and I became such a desperate drinker and then a physical drinker because of the shakes and I couldn't stop. And the hallucinations were so bad. In 1969, me and my buddies decided to go to Detroit. And we hit off to Detroit. We wound up in Phoenix. I'm over there at the North Central at the Apache Hotel. I'm on the fourth floor. Everybody's got a TV and it's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom and it's down the hall. It's $40 a month. I can't get the money to do that. So I got a job with a plumber. I've never plumbed before, you know. He sticks me underneath the house and he says, I want you to string out the copper and I'll come back and get you. You know, and the guy takes off and I'm underneath this house. And I got a pint of Kessler's. And I got a transistor radio. And there's this cat staring at me. And it dawned on me, man, I got it made down here. You know, this is great. You know, I mean, you know, I crawl over to the vent and I see all the cars going by. And I'm, man, I'm on top of the world. Nobody knows I'm down here. I got a pint. I got a radio, got a pet, you know what I mean? I'm ready to set up house under here, you know, a little alarm clock, a toaster, you know. You know? And I felt so good that I capped that seal of that Kessler's, and there's nothing like hot bourbon underneath the house, man. Gets away all that dust, you know. Start shit on fire, you know. And so I start doing hammering stuff, and I keep nipping off that Kessler's, and 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath the house, you know. And apparently I had broken into the house up through the floor in the bedroom and I robbed the lady of all of her jewelry and money and took it underneath the house and they're dragging me out and this cat comes running out and it's got a bunch of necklaces on, you know. Can I have that coffee? So I get another job and I meet this guy down at the Wagon Wheel Bar, Ernie. Ernie's an idea man. Ernie was from Tennessee. Larry, he says, I know how we're going to make some money. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. You know, I figure we're going to be working out and stuff like that, you know. And the guy has a bag of speed, and I've never done that. I've just been minding my own business, just drinking and doing heroin, not bothering anybody, you know. I don't know what that stuff is, you know. I'm not into going that fast, you know. I want you to do, I want you to take this stuff. In 2 months, we'll go weigh you in. And he takes off, you know. And he comes back 2 weeks later, and I'm stuck in the same spot in that room. I'm just, you know. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I'm stuck in my room, and I can't get out of my room. I'm chasing flies around, you know, and I'm looking out in my shades of my little window, and I'm seeing these black and white flashes, and it's the sun going up and down, you know. And I'm... Long story short is I got caught writing prescriptions down there is what I did. I got caught writing prescriptions, a lot of prescriptions for a long time, and they sent me down to Southern Arizona for a little while. In 1974, I come back to L.A., and they give me a little... Greyhound Hotel in downtown Torrance and a voucher, and I'm 2 months without drinking, and they find me at a Little League dugout in El Segundo, California, 10 o'clock in the morning, absolutely sober, absolutely out of my mind. In between hysterical and maniacal, my paranoia is so bad that I'm hallucinating. And I'm in a place that I've never been before, and if I've ever been close to that place, I come out of it. But this time I'm snapped in and I'm frightened, and I don't know what's going on. And they call the paramedics down, and they take me to the Harvard General Hospital. The Harvard General Hospital diagnoses that because of some of my drug overdoses in my jacket that, and some of my suicide attempts, that maybe I need to go to a state hospital out by Oxnard to be observed for about 30 days. And so they sent me out there, and a year later they let me out, you know, and I was totally observed by that time, you know. And they gave me my little pills to take, some stuff called liquid shock and some Thorazine and stuff, and they told me I wouldn't be able to operate without them, like I'm going to operate, you know. And after 2 months, I ran out of my Thorazine, and they found me at Alvaro Street, curled up behind a Chevron station, a public drunk, a public nuisance. I'm not a big-time convict. I'm not nothing. But they found me curled up over there, a public nuisance. And they rolled me up and sent me up to Wayside. And I'm up at Wayside for about 40 days. And they put a bunch of us in a black and white bus and sent us down to the South Bay Courthouse. I'm in a holding tank about this size. And there's nothing but concrete and benches and bologna sandwiches. And everybody's gone. I'm sitting on a concrete floor with my Vons bag and no hope. And I'm wondering where they're going to take me now. It's time to go. I know we're going somewhere. And I hear these keys coming down the hall. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. And he says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Why don't you come with me, son? We're going to AA. AA? I said, "I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? Now, I had no idea that I just laid my eyes on my first trusted servant. He was a trusted servant. A trusted servant, you don't have to be nominated or elected. A trusted servant. This man toted your message for fun and for free. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a sheriff. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a little refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life, and that his wife was dying immediately. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat still long enough to hear the sweet voice of a loving God and grasp that first paragraph of working with others that tells us, practical experience tells us, nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. And he knew that she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. And he whipped his little car around to the South Bay Courthouse. He talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and they said, "I think we got a guy for you." And he went down and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm ready for a long drive and maybe some lunch. And he takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting. And in that car, he tells me some things I've never... He says, "Son, I know you've had a tough life and I know you feel different. The earmark of the alcoholic, drunk or sober, what matter what group he's with, he's always able to eventually feel different for some reason." And he says, "Larry," he says, "I know you feel different. But we're going to take you to Alcoholics Anonymous, son, and I can't wait for you to see these people. I can't wait." And he says, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." He says, "Nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted." And that man rolled up to that dingy Alano Club, man, and I mean it was dingy. And he rolled up to this little dingy Alano Club in Torrance. And he introduced me to all these people, man, Indian Genie and Captain Bill and Moose and, you know, Singing Sam, Serenity Sam, Bicycle Ray, Santa Claus Ray, Dancing Pete, Whistling Butt, all these other people, you know. And, my God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. And little Moose come running after me like some kind of tissue commercial, you know. "Hi, honey, my name is Moose and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are, man." I thought, believe me, I'm not it, man, you know. And this transvestite came out of the card room, you know, and he started circling me like the Goodyear blimp, you know. And after about three turns, he came around and he landed. He come walking. He says, "I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so, you know." Not till I get a year anyway, you know. I said, my God, that guy's got big feet, you know. And what's wrong with him, you know? That's not right, you know. And I said, my God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of this, you know. And these big-feeted people running around here, you know. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And that don't make me a better member or a worse alky. All that did is prove to me one important thing, that if I don't change, my sobriety date will. You know, and I don't have the power to change. I'm powerless. This isn't about coming to AA and getting empowered. This is about remaining powerless. And you come to believe, for me, that a power greater than myself will restore me to... And what is sanity? Sanity is that this time won't be different. It will not be different. And I bought that idea, and I believe it today. And I don't got to be years in front of that idea. I don't got to be miles in front of that idea. All I got to be is one step ahead of that insane idea. And I stay one step ahead by stepping with you. The most important step a newcomer can make is to start stepping with us. You start running with us, and your life will lift. My newcomers don't even know they're working the first three steps, and they are. They're getting a sponsor, they're going to their home group, they're following direction, they're doing their prayers, they're showing up. What is that other than a man doing the first three steps? He's powerless, he's coming to believe, he's turned his life over to us and a sponsor. That's the first three steps. You don't got to figure that out. It doesn't have to be anything magical and mystical. You just got to stay one step ahead of that insane idea, because no longer how you stay sober, that insane idea comes back. Now, what do you mean? I thought the obsession would be removed. It is. Well, then how come people with time get drunk? Because the obsession to drink never comes back as a form of a drink. The obsession to drink always comes back as a form of, I don't need to do this anymore. I've got to go get my work boots. And all of a sudden, things that were committed and that were regular, you had a regular routine, things that were regular are now in the way. And you can only show up to take your cake and tell everybody about your blessings as your friends watch you hang yourself with your great blessings, because you forget to come back to the place that blessed you when nobody would. You forget to come back to the place that gave everything in life you ever had, because you're too busy taking care of your personal achievements. Your personal achievements. That dang near killed me. Because all my life I've been coming from behind. And there was nothing like finally getting mine. Finally getting a piece of this stuff, getting a couple bucks, getting all that. And I got really goofy. I got scared. I got scared enough to start sponsoring guys. I got scared enough to start doing some things instead of just start talking about some things. And eventually when I started living for the cause instead of living for me, things started happening. Now how does God show himself to a guy like me? The closer you stay adhered to this program, and the more willing you become to share that knowledge here, he will appear. The more service you are, he just starts to show up. The more busy you are in AA, you can't help but see him. And your hunt's over. Your hunt's over. Everything you need to make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that hinders that happiness will be removed by the program of our... You don't have to go anywhere else to get anything else done. And the answer to all my problems is the same. Grab that new son of a gun. Grab that new guy. You got trouble with Rosie? Grab that new guy. You don't have any trouble with Rosie? Grab two guys. You know? You got fired from work? Get three guys. You know what I mean? Perpetuation of the gift. Relieve me of the bondage of self. The answer to sobriety and the good life is the same. I don't have a bunch of different answers. I got to continue to do the same thing. And I tell you, for a guy like me, there's blessing in the rut. There's blessing in that rut. People call me a bunch of little goofy names because I'm a regular Monday, Wednesday, Thursday guy. But I tell you, there is nothing like that routine. Because when I'm crazy, I know where to go. And there's nothing worse than an alky being lost and afraid and sober and crazy, staying home, trying to figure out where he's going to go tonight. But when you have a routine of meetings, by golly, you would rather show up with your ass out than any place else. Because there's nothing like the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous working on you when you feel like that, because you'll have the best meeting you ever had. And what you'll find happening to you is that Alcoholics Anonymous takes the most decent thing you have left, your feet, and they train your feet. They train your feet. Just like on payday, you're always going to Eddie's Liquor Store. Boom. Boom. And you go to these routine meetings and you'll find yourself in the shower going, I'm not going. Oh, I'm not going. He's going to be there. He's talking. She's going to, I am not going. I'm feeling sick. I am not going. I'm feeling sleepy. I am not going. I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going. You know? And you not go yourself all the way to the damn meeting, man. You know? You're sitting around people you'd not wanted to be with, shaking hands with people you'd not wanted to take home, and you find yourself not doing shit. And halfway through the meeting, when they read the traditions, you feel elated. And you did something you totally didn't want. And it is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous right there, is showing up. The most important thing in my life is not my sponsor and not that book. It's my seat. And heaven forbid anything that comes between me and that seat. That's where the magic takes place. It doesn't take place out in the parking lot, right there in that seat where these two ladies are talking. You know, that's where it takes place, man. And I don't ever, yep. And I don't ever let anybody get in something. I didn't come all the way to hear them, you know. And if anything gets in the middle of that, I've got to have that removed from my life. I've got to be with you. There is no other answer for me, you know. And going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, finally on May 2nd, 1982, I'm over at the Woolworth. I'm looking at myself in a Woolworth window. It's May 2nd, 1982. I've got my street mod out. Everything I own is on my back. I don't have a wine bottle in my pocket. I'm absolutely sober, and I'm getting ready to check into a mission. And I look at myself in this mirror, and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. And I checked into the mission, and I called this guy who was coming to get me. And every time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous in central office, somebody would always come and get me, and they were always clean and they were sharp, which is why I wear a tie right now. I don't wear it because I think I'm sharp and effective. I'm aware because there's people in this room right now who showed me how to have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. They showed me how to have respect for my sponsor, and soon enough I should be able to show respect to a wife and everything else. I wear it because I love you. I wear it because that's the least I can do is clean up a little. Anybody can come here with their dirty plumbing clothes on, but my peace starts coming with extra efforts. When you start making those extra efforts for AA, it's not a matter, if you're new, be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, you know? Because it has nothing to do with convenience. The most inconvenient things are the most life-saving things that you have in your routine. It ain't about doing what's comfortable. It's about doing the uncomfortable to get comfortable. You know that. That's what eventually you got to get used to. You know? That it has nothing to do to appeal with the emotions. It's about these actions that we have here that go totally against the grain, which is why they work. They cannot be figured out. They have to be applied. And you have to begin to live for that cause. Because if you're not living for the cause, you're living for yourself. And that's what got me here, you know. And on May 2nd, 1982, I called central office, and this guy named Don was always coming and getting me. And I called central office, and it was Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm down here at the Beacon Light Mission. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't get your rusty ass down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. Whatever happened to that AA love, you know? I just heard it. And I took the longest walk of my life, that 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance with my poopy pants and no hope. I waddled into this little club. They didn't want me there. And I said, is Don there? And they said, he's over by the coffee bar. I waddled up to that guy and I asked him something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't ask him for a dollar, and I didn't ask him for a ride home. I didn't ask him for take me down to the detox. I couldn't get in those places anymore. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. And on May 2nd, 1982, I stepped in step with you. Now, after about 2 years sober, I started judging my sponsor, and some things were going on in his life, and I started separating myself. And 2 years sober, I found myself without a sponsor in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely out of my mind. And 2 years sober, I'm down at this club, and a man came down there and told me what I was. He says, "You're an AA pimp. You're a taker." He says, "There's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, son. I hope you found it." And I followed that guy to my home group. I never had a home group. And I followed that to my home group meeting, the Monday night big book group in Bellflower, California. And by having that man sponsor me, he took me to my Wednesday night meeting in Pacific Group, where I began to meet some friends and some peers with guys that I love. And I began to take this thing into my life. I never had a home group. They say home is where the heart is. And I believe that's what my home group's all about. Recreating this, perpetuating this gift. Recreating an atmosphere that was created for me when I got there. Setting up chairs and being accountable, because guys look for you on that chair like I look for my sponsor. Knowing where you're supposed to give, you know. Having this little family of sobriety here. And pretty soon, this little idea that these were your meetings, they became my meetings. It was my group. And then after you start applying some traditions, you start seeing that it's our group. And that it's our common welfare. And it's our loving God. And it's our group conscience. And it becomes our great blessings. And these things that were obligations begin to be privileges. It becomes God's great blessing to see you wandering around with his kids. The most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. I sit in a magical place on Wednesday. I got my sponsor and my grand sponsor sitting behind me. And me and Frank and John Graff are sitting in Murderer's Row right in front of them. And we listen to those two guys talk all through the damn meeting. I mean, they don't let up, man. I had a guy come up to me a couple of months ago, and he says, "Hey, does Clancy sit behind you?" And I go, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I haven't heard Clancy in 5 years." And I said, "Take my seat. You can hear him all night long, you know." And I tell you, I started working these steps, and I started making some amends. And I want to tell you about my mom. One of the main things that I do with the guys that I work with is I get them back to their moms. I get them back to their dads and their wives and their children, and I get them back in this thing called life and family. I get them back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the nightmares of my life was the night that I woke up and I was crawling through my mom's house looking for a whiskey bottle, and I started beating her up. I started smacking her around till I got some blood coming out of her nose, looking for a bottle that I know she hid from me. And I found it. I found it the next morning. It was in the trash can. I'd put it there. Now, that lady had every right in the world not to ever see me and have anything to do with me again. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these amends, it takes more than an afternoon and a note. And I tell you what I do. Now, I'm a happily married man, but every week I cheat on my wife. I date my mom. And I go, you bet, I go over there and I sit with that lady. And I tell you, she's the finest. It is my privilege to be her son. And you know what these steps have done? That very thing that I robbed from my mom and dad called peace of mind is now back. She don't worry no more. And I have so much fun with this lady. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable how comfortable she feels with me and how, you know, like I'm getting ready to send her a postcard from you guys, you know. And we have such fun together. I visited her not too long ago. She lives in a little old folks home, and she's about 5 floors. And every balcony, they have their own little balcony and flowers and stuff. And I went to visit my mom not too long ago, and we're sitting there. And she's got plastic flowers. I says, "Mom," I says, "look it." I said, "Why don't you let me plant you some nice roses?" "I don't want no roses." "No," I said, "I'll take care of them. Let me get you some roses and lilies, and we'll get rid of these plastic flowers." "Honey, I don't want no roses and lilies. I like my plastic flowers." I says, "Mom, you don't understand. I'll take care of them. Let me get you." She said, "I don't want your damn roses." She says, "I want my plastic flowers because I love to see the hummingbirds suffer." So I got all these plastic rubber trees over there now and shit, man. You know, she just has a ball, man. I got a 20-year-old daughter that I wasn't supposed to see in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got married early on, and the only time I got married was when in AA. And I got married, and I had a beautiful daughter. And my little daughter is so smart that not too long ago she called me up and she said, "The kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart." She said, "Did that ever happen to you?" I said, "Hell yeah." And I went over and visited, and you know, if I could go to Oklahoma, I can visit my daughter in Phoenix, because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous and my grand sponsor told me, he says, "You may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at, son." And she knows. And I write her on Pocahontas paper. She's 20 years old. And I went over there not too long ago, and sitting across from me on my daddy-daughter date was my little girl. And she had her mom's earrings on. She had her nose pierced. She had a safety pin in her eye. And she had a tattoo on her stomach that looked like the Sunday morning comic strip. And she's looking at me and she says, "Daddy, what are you staring at?" And I said, "The most beautiful little girl I've ever seen in my life." And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because every meeting I go to, you talk to me that behind every tattoo and every bandana and every nose piercing, there's an alky in there. There he is. You talk to the alky, not the jewelry. And when I see that little girl, behind every tattoo and every piercing, there's a little set of Cuban eyes in there, and that's my little girl, and I love her. She said, not too long ago, she says, "Daddy, I need $3,000. She says, "It'll help me in school and in some of my personal areas of life, but it really helped me in school, and Mom said it was okay. Could you loan me the money?" I asked my sponsor, and he says, "Do you got it?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "Why don't you lend her the money? She's never asked for anything before." So I gave my little girl the money. And my last visit, I visited my little daughter, and she had a new set of boobs. Both of them. They were both done, you know. And my first thought is, she must be majoring in oceanography, you know. I've been married to Rosie for 10 years. I met her in a speaker meeting in Downey 9 years ago, and I was speaking at a meeting, and I fell in love with this little Nicaraguan lady. I was staring at her all through the meeting. And after the meeting, I followed her out to her car like a lost terrier, you know, and we were talking, and she looked at me, and she says, "Do you like the backpack?" I said, "I love it, you know, and there's nothing about me that says backpacking or camping, you know what I mean? I spent enough time out there, you know." And I says, "I love it," because I thought, anything to get into the tent, you know. And I tell you, I've been calling that lady ever since. And I love her because I know she don't need me. And I know that I love her is because she became the first woman that I told other women about. And I love her so much that I don't want to cheat on her. I love her so much that I don't want to make her sad. And I always want her to be happy with me. I love the way I feel when I'm away from that lady thinking about her. And I don't want to jeopardize that. I don't want her to ever come across the thing that I know I can become. And I want to treat her with the kindness and the tenderness that you folks have taught me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to not use her selfishly and loathly. I love that lady a lot. In these little rooms that you stick me in, there's a little Bible, and I'm not a Bible guy. I don't know why, but I've never knew much about religion. But in our rooms, there's this little air conditioner thing, this little box, and it was stuck on the Bible. And the page that it was stuck on was a beautiful story. And it always makes me think of my sponsor when they talk about Jesus as the carpenter, because Johnny's sponsor, Chuck, used to talk to him as the carpenter. And there's this story, and it goes like this, and then we'll wrap this thing up. The carpenter was having a dinner. And so he grabbed his peasant and he says, "Go out into town and tell everybody that was poor and maimed and who is now saved that I'm having a dinner and I'm inviting them. And the peasant went out there and he went over to the blacksmith and he said, who was once poor, he says, you know, the carpenter's having a dinner and he wants you to come. And the blacksmith says, I've got 100 new horses, I've got a shoe. Tell the carpenter I'm too busy. And he went over to the cobbler, who was once poor and maimed and now saved. And he said, the carpenter's having a dinner and he wants you to come. And the cobbler says, tell the carpenter I'm too busy. And he went to the farmer, who was poor and maimed and now saved. And he says, you know, the carpenter's having a dinner and he wants you to come. And the farmer says, I have no crops. I've got to farm the land. Tell the carpenter I'm too busy. He went back to the carpenter and he told him, he says, where's all these people who were poor and now saved? Where are they? Why ain't they at my dinner? And the peasant said, they were all too busy. And the carpenter told the peasant, go back out there. And you go out further. And you go deep into the streets. And you find some people who are poor and maimed and you invite them to my house. And let no plate go until they're all filled. And you tell those people who were once poor and saved, who did not come, that they will never again eat of my supper. My friends, you put on a magical banquet. Every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is a magical banquet. Don't ever get too busy for the carpenter. Don't ever get your life too busy to come back to the place that blessed you when no one else would. Always find time to come back and perpetuate this gift. The magical thing in my life is a guy who was always afraid of a higher power, running from him at night. I've always had nightmares. I've always been afraid of this thing called God because I was wondering what he was going to do to me. I find myself in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't worry about what he looks like or what he sounds like because I'm looking him straight dead in the eye right now. I'm looking at him straight dead in the eye. And the idea of a higher power never enters my mind because tonight there's row after row after row of people in Oklahoma who should be dead. And look at us now. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. And though I may not see his little face, damn it, I'm going to be playing in the evidence all weekend long. Thank you.